So I'm normally talking to business leaders, owners, and entrepreneurs, but today's episode is going to be a little bit different. I'm talking to the leaders of a nonprofit organization. They have been in business for nearly a decade, business and organization in on mission, I should say. I should edit this, but I'm not going to. And man, the work that they do is so incredible. They've been able to scale an organization and create an impact like many of us would love to be able to make, especially when you look back over 10 years and go, what have I done? Dean and Sherry Porter from Hunger Fight really have an incredible story to share. You're going to learn a lot about how they built this organization. If you run a nonprofit or if you run a business, this is going to be a helpful conversation for you for things to think through. I also think it'll be encouraging to see people doing good things out there. There's a lot of chaos in the world, and it's nice to look around and see the helpers. And that's who I have on this episode. Without any further ado, here's my conversation with Dean and Sherry. Hey, Sherry and Dean, welcome to the show.
Howdy. Thank you for being us here. Thank you for allowing us to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. You know, so often on these shows, I'm interviewing entrepreneurs or business leaders who have started businesses. And today I get to interview y'all who have started a nonprofit. I mean, you didn't just start it. You started it quite a while ago. And I think there's a lot of similarities, though, between starting a business and starting a nonprofit. To some extent, you got to build organizational structure. You got to have people that come alongside you. You got to get people aligned on a mission, and then you got to get things done in order to accomplish that mission. So before we jump in to any of the details of all that, what I'd love to hear from y'all is a little bit about, you know, what made you start this organization? Because I think we've all got a limited amount of time in our days and weeks, and we got to figure out what to do with that. And to start a nonprofit like you have done with Hunger Fight requires a massive amount of energy and effort. So why did you do it?
Wow. Short answer?
Yeah, whatever answer you want to give is great.
The short answer is God. The long answer, my wife absolutely loves to volunteer. And my first year dating her, she volunteered me 30 weekends doing something from special needs children to MS to breast cancer. And she just loves to give back. I mean, she just has that giving heart of helping people. And so every time I turned around, I found her going, "Hey, honey, what are we doing this weekend?" And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, what time do I have to wake up?" And so eventually I looked at her and I said, "I love you. This is amazing. And we've met some of the most amazing people." But I asked her, I said, "Could you pick a lane?" And she started researching hunger and was just absolutely appalled by childhood hunger. And I'll let you take it from there and tell her what you found.
Oh, just found kids going home every day, not being able to eat. You know, they can eat at school, but when they go home, they may not have anything. And then on the weekends, they have nothing the whole weekend. So I figured this is the best place to put our efforts and our energy to try and help them out. So That's where we started, and didn't expect it to grow into what it is, but it took off, and now it's going like crazy.
Yeah, we actually both owned marketing companies, and we were going to just do this on the side. And like I said, God had other plans, because about 6 months into it, it just exploded. And she looked at me and she goes, "You know, one of us has got to go full time." And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "Well, get busy." And I was like, "Hold it. This was your idea." And here we are 9 years later. And I would have never, ever in my wildest dream thought we'd be sitting here 9 years later doing this full time.
Well, most businesses and organizations don't make it that long. Most businesses especially fail within the first year. I think a lot of nonprofits do as well. They just can't get the backing. And very few make it past 3 to 5. So to make it to nearly a decade now is a big deal. And just to give people a context, when you say, you know, you've done a lot, just tell them a little bit about like how many meals you've packed. It's not just meals. You now also deliver books to kids to help with their, you know, education and literacy. So like how many meals have y'all packed so far, and how many books have you distributed?
We've surpassed now 13.1 million meals and a little over 162,000 books.
That is amazing.
Over 2 years. So, yeah.
I mean, just for people listening, like 13 million meals. And those are 13 million meals that very likely those children would not have otherwise. And I think when I think about, or when I used to think about, we've worked together, but so I know a lot about y'all, but when I used to think about childhood hunger, to be fair, like I very usually would think of that in the context of other countries or other places, not necessarily here in my own backyard. We do a lot of, my wife and I get a lot of work down in Haiti, and you see a ton of that there. But talk a little bit about like that kind of focus of local children, people right here in our own backyards.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because most people think of hunger today in America is what we see on the streets, the street corner, the person standing there with the sign saying they're out of work or they're homeless and they're pining for food or for money. When in fact, hunger in America is that child next to your child in school, the child sitting next to you in the pew at church. That's hunger in America. You know, it's one in four children. It's one in three children, depending on what county you're in. Sometimes it's one in eight. You get into the rural counties just outside of Jacksonville. You get into Putnam County, Bradford County. It's one in eight, one in nine. Those are alarming statistics. And, you know, it's easy to hide when you get into like St. John's County, it's one in 10. It's easy to have that one in 10 child kind of get shuffled off to the side. But when you got 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10 children, I mean, that's staring you right in the face. And so it's people don't realize that it's that family that's literally right around the corner from you, or the family that's sitting right next to you in church. It's America. That's America today. That is what's called food insecure. We think of hunger as the homeless, and yet that's less than 1/10 of hunger in America.
Wow.
It's not 9% is hunger in America is the homeless. 9%.
Wow. So, you know, those numbers are, I think, shocking for people that are listening who aren't aware. And I think a lot of times when you think about problems that need to be solved, I mean, whether it's your own personal problem or something else, I mean, the first kind of step is acknowledging that there is a problem, like to understand like, hey, there's something needs to be solved here. Now, what I'm curious about that kind of came to mind as you were talking is, you know, with any kind of organization, whether it's a company or a nonprofit, there's usually somebody else who's done some version of what we're doing. You know, we all bring unique things to the table, but like, you know, there's other organizations that help with hunger. There's other organizations that help with doing what we do. So what made you go, you know what, instead of going to, what gave you that? Because it's kind of an entrepreneurial thing. Like, what made you go, hey, we're going to start our own thing instead of going, hey, this is that we're going to go into this organization over here that already exists. What was the mindset there?
Well, you've got your food banks, you've got your backpack programs. You know, the backpack programs that are out there, there's a lot of great ones, but they mainly send juice packs and snacks home. And we realize that the, you know, elementary children, they share. And if they're just sending juice packs and snacks in the backpack program, if I'm on a bus with Sherry and we're both elementary students and Sherry doesn't have anything and she's hungry and I share and I'm hungry, by the time I get off the bus, I have nothing for the weekend. And they're trying to send stuff home for the weekend for me. I've shared it with Sherry and I've eaten what I want to eat. I get off the bus, I still have nothing for the weekend. So the backpack program concept is great, but I've shared and I've ate most of everything. By the time I get off the bus, I still have nothing. Mm. Got the food pantries and food banks, which are great. They're recycling food from Publix and Winn-Dixie and Kroger. They're recycling canned goods and perishable goods. So we wanted to come in with a niche. We wanted to come in and specifically help those that could not help themselves, that being just the elementary children, because they're 100% dependent upon family and society, and what I call the ultimate senior, because it becomes like a full cycle of life again. If you're fortunate enough to live in your late 80s, early 90s, you become very childlike again. Hold a job much anymore, and you're very dependent upon society and family again. And so those are our niche marketers, those that cannot help themselves. And so we like to collaborate with the backpack programs that are out there and add our nutritious standalone meals that are meals that they actually have to take home and eat. That being our beans and rice meal, our cheesy mac meal, and our oatmeal brown sugar meal. So if you put that with their snack packs and their juice packs, that if they actually end up eating that on the bus or sharing that with people on the bus, and they have our meal with that, by the time they get home, they still have a nutritious meal or two to eat over the weekend. And so it supplements what the other existing great programs are already doing. So our niche is to collaborate with those existing programs or go into schools that have no program at all and just provide our meals.
So a lot of people have ideas like this, right? Whether it's business or nonprofit, you go, the problem is child hunger in this case, and we want to help solve that problem. And as you said, there's a lot of different ways that people go about doing that. And you kind of landed on this idea, and then you put together these three different, you know, shelf stable, easy to carry, easy for them to take home, easy to make, nutritionally balanced meals. But that's a lot to come up with, because I'd be like, I don't even know where to start. So how did you figure that out in the process? Because it's really product development, no different than, you know, a company trying to develop a product that's going to be efficient and marketable. In this case, it needs to be efficient and something that you can get people together to produce and then get out in the marketplace. So how did you put those pieces together?
Well, we went and visited a company that does something similar to ours, mostly for third world countries and all. We went and visited them to see what they were doing, how they were doing it. And we kind of built off of their meals that they already were providing. But we brought ours back and had some nutritionists work with us to make it more, I guess you'd say,
domestic tasting.
Yeah, more for domestic and not the starving people in these other countries.
Sure.
Worked with them and came up with different flavors of our cheese. And we use Kraft cheese in our mac and cheese. And we wanted to use meals that they could build off of. So they could take mac and cheese and turn it into so many different meals and add to what they're getting maybe from the, you know, food pantries and stuff to make it a bigger meal and not just, you know, like a can of tuna. You can't really feed a whole family off a can of tuna. But when you put it in with mac and cheese and make a tuna casserole, you have a whole meal that may last them for a little while. So we did that. We built off of some of the meals they were already doing, but we put our own spin on the flavor and the recipe for it.
Yeah, that's super smart.
Yeah, the UNF department, the nutrition department at UNF was very instrumental in helping us take the concept that a lot of the international companies were already using, but yet twist and turn the flavor to a domestic flavor, because the international companies deal with starvation, something we don't deal with. So their nutrition and their taste was very, their nutrition was totally different dealing with starvation that we don't deal with, because we only deal with hunger. And their taste was, as some would describe it, like cardboard, very bland. But when you're dealing with starvation and you're eating a mud pie in Haiti, cardboard tastes pretty good. But for us here, domestic tasting, that was not something that was appealing.
So it's an interesting distinction that you made there. And I think that the idea of talking about a niche market going, hey, we're going to primarily focus on elementary school age kids, and we're going to create a product that is nutritious, but also that they're going to actually eat and not just toss in the bin. And then the distinction there too, between starvation and hunger. So walk people through that a little bit, like what you would define as starvation and what you would define as hunger. Because I think that what you're doing is you're niching down, and businesses do the same thing all the time. But talk about that distinction a little bit between starvation and hunger.
Well, in starvation, you're dealing with children with the distended tummies and things that are on the verge of possibly dying sometimes within hours. Mm-hmm. That's what children deal with in Haiti and in Africa and places, third world countries that deal with on a daily basis, weekly basis. We don't deal with that here in America at all. We just deal with hunger issues of what's deemed as food insecurity. They don't you normally have three meals a day. Hunger is where they're going without meals for days. Mm-hmm. Our children don't deal with that. They just deal with food insecurity. And so the difference in the protein levels and the nutritional issues that need to go into those meals for hunger, for starvation versus hunger are totally different. And so therefore it really distorts the taste and makes it very, very bland as well. And so we needed to tone down that nutritional value because we don't need that in that here in these meals. And therefore it was able to change the taste and make it more domestic tasting as well.
It makes a lot of sense. You know, I think what's interesting about that is I think about, you know, my own kids and, you know, they'll say things like, I'm starving. And I'm like, you're not starving. You might be hungry, but you're not starving. But I remember specifically my two youngest, I have five kids and my two youngest are adopted. And we went through the foster program for a while. And I remember going in the training for that foster program. And one of the parts that broke my heart that kind of relates to this was they were saying, like, many times when you foster a child, many of them came from places where they had food insecurity. And so it's not uncommon for them to, like, hoard. Like, if they see food in the house, they'll take that and hide it under their bed because they I can't even talk about that. They'll take it and hide it under their bed because they are worried when they're going to get their next food. And so one of the things they told us to do was like put a bowl of fruit out or something that's healthy on the counter and say, hey, this is always going to be here. You can always come back and get more food. Oh, man. And like, I mean, this, the idea that like a child doesn't have enough food is just, you know, devastating. And I think it's so awesome that you all have really dedicated your lives to, you know, make that happen. But let's talk about this. 13 million meals is no joke, right? It requires a serious scaling out, even over 9 years. It's still a ton. I mean, you're talking about, you know, millions of meals per year in some cases, or at least hundreds of thousands even in the early years. So, like, how did you scale that apparatus? Talk to people a little bit about how that works, because I think people get stuck there in all kinds of organizations. It's like, great, we've created some meals and we can get them out to, you know, 20 families, but how do we do it for 1,000? How do we do it for 10,000? So talk about how you actually put together these meals, because I think that's super interesting.
Well, we host events all throughout the year where we package as small of an event as a 10,000 meal event to as large as a million meal packing event where we lives in 2 days, over 7,000 volunteers. We've done that twice now out in Salt Lake City, Utah, where we host an annual event out there. Every community that we host an event at, the meals stay in that community. So if we host an event in Miami, Florida, the meals stay in Miami. If we host it in Salt Lake City, they stay in Salt Lake City. So currently I think this past year we did just under 2.8 million meals. Wow. Our first year, to give you an idea, we were just over 330,000 meals. So that's the difference. It's grown over the last 9 years. And so it's, but we host events all throughout the year. So it might be a church. Like this weekend, we have a church. Dunn's Creek Baptist is hosting their fifth annual event, in which their congregation is coming together. They're the host. They're funding it. All their volunteers from their congregation are coming together. They're packing the meals, and the meals are going to go back into the community. Because currently we service a little over 18,000 children on a weekly basis from Tallahassee to Ocala, all throughout the First Coast. And we just opened up Valdosta, Georgia this past week. So we're now servicing a few hundred children in Valdosta, Georgia as well.
So you get churches or companies or other organizations to come alongside you. And what's so cool about that is, you know, you're creating a place where, and I actually really want to schedule these. I keep saying this, but I need to actually do it. Schedule one of these for our company, where you're getting teams to get together. And so it's such a like triple win, you know, because the team, whether it's the company or a church or another organization of some kind, they're getting together and they're doing something that gives them kind of a positive feel good. You're getting the boots on the ground, hands and feet that you need to get the work done, basically. And then the kids obviously are benefiting because they've got the food that they need in these instances. So it's just a great idea. How did you come up with the idea of the packing event?
We actually saw it done before with an organization that did something similar to ours. We went and just asked if we could talk to the gentleman, volunteer with him. We saw it, how it was done. We both come from marketing backgrounds. When we saw it, we realized this is exactly what we want to do. And again, like I said, we were going to do it on the side. That's when we flew out to Iowa to meet with several of the international companies and kind of do some more homework. After talking to them and talking to a lot of one of the organizations called Kids Against Hunger, they kind of have like franchisees. Most of them told us to run it like a marketing company, and coming from marketing backgrounds, we were like, well, that should be easy. We should be good. No, and I know nothing about a nonprofit. I still think I know nothing about nonprofits. thought, well, this should be cool. We should do this. Okay. We're all right. This, we should be able to do this on the side with no issues. And so we came home and prayed about it and said, let's give it a shot. And here we sit. And again, no idea that it would blow up like it's done. And it has just been such a blessing and such an experience to just see and listen to the stories that you hear from the teachers and the administrators. And Jay, I'll go back to a story that bleeds right into what you were talking about, your children. We had a teacher that told us that, I'll just say that young man's name was Johnny. But she saw Johnny every day putting food in his pocket at lunch. She couldn't figure out why. And so on Friday, she asked him, and he thought he was in trouble. And she said no. And she said, he told the teacher these, I just want to make sure that me and my little brother have food over the weekend to eat. And she had watched him that day on Friday open up a muffin, and he realized it, and he tried to close it back up and stuffed it in his pocket. Yeah.
Yeah, that stuff, I mean, that is hard to swallow. I remember
he was doing that.
I think what's so, to some extent, it's encouraging to see children go, hey, I've got to help provide. It's horrible, but it's also encouraging to go, hey, I'm going to provide for more than myself. I remember one time, actually, we were in Haiti, and we, one of the things we did through vacation Bible school is we'd always give them like a peanut butter sandwich at lunch. And almost none of the kids would eat the whole sandwich. They would take part of it, and then they would hand it off to like their mom or somebody else, you know, and maybe they'd been instructed to do that, maybe not, but you know, it's like heartbreaking to go, man, they're trying to split up a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And, you know, my kids are arguing over like what kind of pasta sauce we're putting on, you know, the spaghetti. And it's a hard reality. One thing that's really coming to mind that I'm curious about how y'all have handled, because everybody has struggled with this, regardless of what industry or niche they're in, is COVID. Because for you, I feel like it's got to have been kind of a double-edged sword, because on one hand, these kids who are many times getting a lot of their food at school, in many cases, are not at school. And I know some counties and things have tried to do different things to help with that, but, you know, it can only go so far. And then I imagine it's probably was harder, at least in the middle of the 2020 and all that, trying to get people together to do a packing event, because we weren't, at some points, weren't even allowed to get together. So how have y'all navigated the complexity of both the increased need and likely a more complex scenario of getting it done?
Well, first off, when schools first went to at-home learning, we tried to help by going to the schools and delivering food there for the parents to come by and pick up, which worked okay for a little while. But then we found out we had to find a way to get it to more kids out there. So we started working with like Boys and Girls Clubs and YMCAs and all these youth activity centers where a lot of the kids were going to have something to do during the day. We were able to get the meals to them so they could take them home from there. And that helped a lot, because we were getting actually more meals out to kids that way than delivering them to the schools. So we had to shift there. But for a while there, packing the meals, our team just had to get together and go in our warehouse in the back and pack the meals ourselves. And once it started opening up, we were able to invite smaller groups to come in and help. And we have great volunteers. I mean, we put a thing out that we're having a packing event that's open to anybody, and we have hundreds of people that want to show up every time. So we have a great base that would come out anytime we asked them to. And we just bring smaller groups in and do shifts. So there weren't many people in the back together. And we were able to pack a bunch of meals that way to still have them to deliver to these organizations that were getting the food out there.
Yeah, go ahead. A lot
of cancellations and postponements in March through June of 2020. They postponed at first, and then after the second wave, those postponements got canceled.
Yeah.
It did affect us in 2020 quite a bit. We've only had one postponement this year so far. I don't think the Omicron is going to affect us like the other one did.
Yeah, I sure hope not. One thing that you said there, Sherry, that I thought was interesting was you're talking about having a great base of volunteers who will show up whenever you kind of ring the bell and ask them to. So that requires good communication. It requires a good culture of some extent. It requires people that believe in what you do. So what are some things that y'all have done over time that have made people do that? Because there's a lot of other organizations who would love to have volunteers that would just show up when they ask them to show up. And I would say most of them do not have that. So what have y'all done over the last 9 years to cultivate that type of, you know, base that will show up when you need them?
A lot of them, when they come for the first time, they're hooked. They go through the packing event because it's like high energy. We have the cowbells that you ring after you pack a box and stuff. And they love actually seeing what's being done. They see the boxes stacking up. They're not just being asked, you know, to donate money. They're asking for their, come help us, come, you know, give us your time and pack these meals. So they enjoy it. They always, you know, people love to help and love to do stuff. A lot of people don't know where they can go to actually hands-on do stuff in groups. So we provide that for them, and they come back time and time and time again. They call us and ask us when we're having another one, when can come to another one. And we've built a great base that way.
Yeah, we call it 2 hours of controlled chaos and dancing to good old 80s music and laughing at my dancing. But the retention rate is, we are so super blessed. Our retention rate's probably in the 87% to 92% retention rate. And I always say it's not 100% because either somebody sold their business, a new management's come on board and they've got to put their stamp of approval, or their process is a little bit different, but it's never because they didn't like what was done. It's just, there's been a little bit of a shift or they've had a bad year. But yeah, we are just very, very blessed with them liking what they do. The teenagers are always asking their parents to come back and do it again. And we were able to use children as young as 6 years old, which means it can be a family affair. And I think that helps us as a lot as well. We've always been open during COVID too, as far as right now we're able to still have teenagers come get their hours for Bright Future scholarships and stuff. And a lot of nonprofits have not been open during COVID for teenagers to be able to come. So we've been able to help out a lot that way as well.
That's awesome. You know, I think it's interesting as you talked about that, because you kind of blew past a few things as normal for y'all that I actually think are a really big deal, that are little things that make a big difference. So, for example, Cher, you mentioned like the cowbell after you pack a box. So explain what you meant by that.
Well, once you pack the meals up, they go on a grid on the end. After you get 42 bags, you ring the bell and that shows you packed a complete box. And when you're in there and you're, you know, packing these meals, you hear constant cowbells going and everybody's like cheering them on, and they get to where they're a little competitive with each other, trying to beat them to the next ring and stuff. And then they always like seeing the boxes just stacking up, and they love taking pictures of that and taking pictures with them in front of the boxes, you know, after they're packed. So the cowbells are like a big hit. People love the cowbells. I don't
know. 42 pouches, 168 meals, every cowbell.
That's such a simple thing, though, that I think in a lot of companies and organizations they miss. Is it's like, it would be one thing to get a bunch of people in there to do essentially assembly line work, and which traditionally is not exactly the most exciting thing. And what you've said in the context of that is, it's a high energy environment. It's controlled chaos. They're laughing at my dancing and they're getting cowbells, you know, every time we pack the box. And so you're celebrating each one of these small victories. And there's so much to learn from that, I think, in the business world and in the nonprofit world. There's so many times where we just do things and move on to the next one. And I know I'm super guilty of this. It's like, I had somebody the other day, I was sharing like a big win that we had, and they said, well, what did y'all do to celebrate that? And I was like, started on the next project. And I think it's like, you know, packing one box, like it'd be easy just to do that and then move on to the next one. But that ringing a simple cowbell, which costs basically nothing, creates so much energy, and that's awesome.
Yeah. And if you have like imagine your group and three tables, they're going to start bantering back and forth. What do you mean? You guys are, you're slow, man. And it starts going and it keeps going. And it's,
yeah, that's good.
Oh yeah.
So I love how much y'all love the work that needs to be done. I think that really matters. One thing I'm curious about is in any organization or company, there comes a time where you go, maybe we need to add a product. We need to add some other line of service or some other lane. And so you'd said earlier, you know, hey, what lane do we want to stay in? But then you've added a new lane at some point, because I don't think you did it from the beginning, which was books. So why add books on top of food? What was the decision there?
Well, hunger and literacy are the two biggest things for elementary students. And when we found out that 42% of the third graders in our county were not reading to grade level, and that affects them the rest of their school career. Yeah. So I'm not even sure how it even came about. We were, kept learning about it, because we talked to a lot of teachers about the hunger issues to see, how the kids are doing and stuff. And they kept mentioning this, the literacy rate is just incredible. Mm. And we thought, okay, well, see what we can do to help. And we dove into it and started, researching things. And so we figured the way to help the most is to help the 0 to 5-year-old kids get a love to want to learn to read and to read want to read books. They all want the tablets these days. They all want to just push buttons and all, but they don't want to actually read the books. So we're trying to think of, fun ways to get them more, interested in reading the books. So we had this whole big idea right when COVID hit. We were trying to put this all in place. So it kind of hasn't happened yet, but we have guest readers that read books that we put on our website, so they can go and they can look at the, watch the people.
That's a great idea.
And we try to get, people that they see, we have TV news anchors that have read stories for us. We've had some Jaguar players read stories for us. We're trying to get it to where we come around where we can actually take these guest readers to the daycares and have them read books and give the books out to the kids. And to give them, kind of get them excited about getting their new books. And we deliver them once a quarter. And right now, when we pull up in our bus and some of the kids see us, they're so excited because they know they're getting their packets, with their books in it that day. So it's the only way I knew it came about. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the main thing is we've been working with pediatricians over the years. And obviously, without nutrition, you can't stay healthy. You can't sit still. You can't concentrate. You can't exercise. Well, once you've got nutrition in your belly, if you can't read, you're very limited in where you're going to succeed in life. Mm. Literacy is the next step in trying to get success for a child. I mean, obviously, you got to have nutrition, but beyond nutrition, you've got to have literacy. I mean, today, unless you're going into engineering or accounting or something, I mean, they've got calculators on their phones. I mean, math is not what it used to have to be. I mean, you used to have to know a lot of math. Mm-hmm. You don't have to know math like you used to. I mean, you don't have to balance checkbooks anymore like we used to. And so, but literacy is still literacy. You still got to learn how to read and to go anywhere and have success in life. And so when she started looking at the literacy statistics again and how alarming it was, they say post-pandemic, those statistics may jump well into the mid-50s on third graders, not being reading at grade level. That is just scary to think that we're losing an entire, generation of children to literacy. And so it's just something that is something we just needed to jump on. And it's so great. We deliver the books quarterly, but we give them a book for each month. So if we catch a child at birth, they're going to build a library of 60 books before they hit kindergarten, before they age out and get into the school system. And we learned a couple of years ago, which I didn't know, but we always hear of food deserts, but there's actually book deserts in those same communities, which I call communities that need communities of hope. these are communities where children and families just need to know they haven't been forgotten and that they need hope and that there are people out there that still care and that still want them to have the opportunities that I know I took for granted because I was blessed. I had, two parents that cared. And even though we weren't rich, They still made sure that my homework was done every night. They still made sure that I got my hug and my prayers in before I went to bed every night. And, these children still need that.
Yeah. One of the things that you said at the very beginning was, the short answer of why this came about was God. And one of the most impactful things that ever happened to me was we were helping with a literacy program and a woman in her 30s could not read and she would learn to write her name for the first time. And she said, "I'm so excited that one day I'll get to read my own Bible." Wow. And I thought, man, I've got like eight, and we argue over what translation we should read. And you just go, gosh, the power of those two things, a full belly and a literate mind being able to read, that actually creates the opportunity for people to know God more, which is pretty wild when you think about it that way, because, you know, they can explore it on their own versus having to sit and let somebody else tell it to them. And I think there's real power in that, at a much deeper level than just the things that are being provided. And I think that's what's really cool to me.
Yeah. And you can change a child's life. That also, when you talk about these communities of hope that have high dropout rates, it's not just changing a child's life, because we've learned that it changes the parent. That parent that's dropped out of school, that doesn't have great literacy skills, they're able, in the privacy of their own home, with the excitement of that child who's getting excited about reading, be able to sit with that child and get excited again and learn some phonics and learn some basics in the privacy of their home, and go back and fill out an application better. Maybe get back to GED. Wow, that's not just changing the child's life. That's changing the family unit, which starts changing the community, because maybe I see Sherry changing and I'm like, well, what's happening over here? Why is your child getting a book? Why is your family unit changing? Well, then all of a sudden I'm wanting my child to get a book. And all this, because I was thinking that I didn't understand the program. Now I see Sherry's life changing. Now I'm receptive to taking that book that I was afraid to take for my child. It starts changing and bleeding and changing that community. That's what I think is so cool. And when you think about like Jacksonville being a immigration, a relocation city as of the last 18 years, there's 124 languages spoken here now. Mm. Up here in the 70s, it was English and redneck spoken. With 124 languages spoken, it's helping immigrants assimilate better in the privacy of their own home. So again, we're helping change not just the child's life, but we're helping change that family and the community, all with just the basics of a child's book.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful too, to think about, really, for anybody that's listening, whether you're running a business or a nonprofit of any kind, is it's not just about the deliverable of whatever that is, like in this case, food and books. It's about the long-term outcome and impact that creates, because just providing food is exciting, actually, in this particular case, but when you think about what that then provides, or just providing a book, that's exciting. When you think about the idea that it could actually change an entire community, I mean, gosh, that's a whole nother ball game of purpose and why. And I think that's the kind of thing people rally around.
And those 5 and 10 year clips go by a whole lot quicker than we think.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we've talked about a lot of big wins and things that have gone well, but I know in all organizations there's stumbling blocks and obstacles along the way. So what's something that you ran into as you've built Hunger Fight that are things, maybe something, the story that you had to overcome and had to kind of work through hard times? We already talked about COVID, but something other than that, maybe.
I guess biggest thing is getting our name out there. I mean, Jacksonville. Mm. Such a vast area, just Jacksonville itself, forgetting the First Coast, even being bigger, that, sure. You know, you always hear, wow, you've been around 9 years, never heard of you. But then you get someone in Daytona Beach going, God, this is so great, can you bring it to Daytona? And then you get someone in Palatka, this is so great, can you? And it's that you get so stretched so quick because so many people hear about you and they see how great you can do. And so they want it to come there. But then you get someone in Jacksonville going, but I've never heard of you. So how quickly can you stretch yourself out? Do you stay just in your, you know, San Marco community? And so it's really hard to, how do you build it? It's hard to say how quickly can you grow out, but yet stay contained, because it's hard to get your name out there. And I think that's the hardest thing. And ours, because we have to buy from the farmers. None of our food gets donated to us. So we live and die by cash donations. Mm. We don't recycle food. So Publix, Winn-Dixie, Kroger does not come and pull up like it does at Second Harvest and Feeding Northeast Florida. They get to recycle all that food and put it back into the community. So we literally survive on cash donations. And we have to buy the exact ingredients. You can't go buy cooked pinto beans anywhere in town. You can't go buy cooked or dehydrated vegetables anywhere in town, or the powdered soy we use. There's only two ingredients you can buy in town at Restaurant Depot that goes in any of our meals. So nobody can just buy our product and come donate it to us. So that's a different business model. We also don't have open volunteer opportunities because they have all of our opportunities have to be funded first to have a volunteer opportunity. So our business model is a bit different than just saying like Habitat or Feeding Northeast Florida has opportunities for them to come volunteer on a regular basis because they are constantly recycling food that Publix and Winn-Dixie just dropped off. So people call up all the time, can I come volunteer? We'd love for you to, but we just don't have an open opportunity because it has to be funded first.
Right. So like when a company wants to host a packing event or something, I assume that what they then do is basically help cover the cost of the food. I'm assuming that's what normally happens, right? And then their team serves. So for people that are out there listening that are, you know, run businesses or organizations and they want to host a packing event, what's the first thing that they need to do? What does that look like for them to get involved with y'all?
They need to go to our website or call us. Go to our website, hungerfight.org. And click on the that they'd like to host a packing event. And it'll give them the ability to fill out a form to host a packing event. Or they can call our number, 904-374-5623, and ask to host a packing event. And we'll get them information that way. And we'll send them a proposal. We'll go over various different informations about the size and their budget and things of that nature. And we'll send them a detailed proposal about hosting an event.
Awesome. Well, we're going to get an event scheduled for this year for sure here at Business Builders. I think that'll be a lot of fun. I think it'll be good for our team and want to help out as well. I'm encouraged by your mission. We're running out of time. So as we kind of wrap up the show here, you know, the show is called Building a Business That Lasts. In your case, it's an organization, but it's still the same thing. How do we build an organization that lasts? If you wanted to leave some parting thoughts for folks on that topic, you've made it 9 years, almost to the decade mark now. It's a big deal. What's some parting advice that you'd leave with others who are wanting to start organizations or grow to a level that y'all have?
Never, never give up on your dream. Always talk to God and just pick the best partner in the world.
That is wise counsel. Dean and Sherry, thank you so much for being on the show today. For anybody that wants to find more out about their organization, you can just go to hungerfight.org. It was a real joy to have y'all on the show today.
Thank you very much.
All right, that's a wrap. We'll cut the podcast right there and share it out to all the places. Once it's out, we'll send y'all a link to it and let you share it around and stuff like that too. We'll post the video on YouTube and then we'll put the podcast out on all the typical podcast places. So,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was awesome.
Yeah, hope y'all are doing well. Thanks for being here today. I'll let you know once we get this all put together.
Alrighty. Sounds great.
Thank you.
Thanks. See ya. Bye.
And by the way, we absolutely love our website.
Good. I do too. Yeah. I actually show it off all the time. So it's one of my favorite nonprofit ones that we've ever done. So I show it off to people all the time.
But we love it.
Yeah. All right. Y'all have a good one. Bye.